As Bloomberg surges in the polls, his Texas strategy draws national attention. And another billionaire betting on Texas as a turning point, too. Candidate Tom Steyer today on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Our conversation with former hedge fund manager Tom Steyer on how he's pitching himself as an outsider here in the Lone Star State. Also, on this first day of early voting in the primaries, longtime Democratic members of Congress from Texas facing challenges from progressives in a fight for the soul of the party. Plus, religious tattoos. New research suggests they're making a distinctive mark. All that and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this first day. Texans are casting ballots in the 2020 election season. Early voting gets underway today, running through the 28th. If you miss out on that window and want to vote in the primaries, you have one more chance on Super Tuesday, March 3rd, when about a third of all the delegates will be up for grabs. I do believe there will be more on early voting a bit later in the broadcast. Later today, Democrats take to the stage to debate in the race to challenge incumbent Republican Senator John Cornyn. Many of these stations will be broadcasting that live. Pre-game setup starts at 6:20 Central statewide. Let me share with you a paragraph penned by Rick Jervis of USA Today, published a few hours ago, quoting here, "Texas, long a reliably Republican state and historically neglected by Democratic presidential candidates, suddenly finds itself in unfamiliar territory, a relevant and courted state in the middle of a heated Democratic presidential primary season," close quote. Michael Bloomberg, the former New York mayor who skipped out of much of the preamble to this contest, is betting big on Texas with a huge campaign staff and massive ad purchases. You may recall before the Iowa caucuses, former Vice President Joe Biden joined us to talk about issues facing Texas voters. We've reached out to all the Democratic presidential candidates, and today it's Tom Steyer's turn, the California billionaire who's branding himself as an outsider. Mr. Steyer, welcome to the Texas Standard.
David, thank you so much for having me.
You've said there are only two major issues in this election. One of them is climate change. And as you're aware, Texas is number one in wind energy right now. But when it comes to what powers the Lone Star State's economy, you know, that doesn't come close to paying the bills like carbon-based energy does. If you want to win Democrats in Texas, how do you make the pitch for radical change?
Well, we're going to have to rebuild the whole country, David. And that's going to mean enormous job creation everywhere. If we're going to actually move to clean energy, we're going to also have to rebuild affordable housing around this country. We're going to have to create public transportation. There is an enormous job ahead of us. It's going to create over 4.5 million good-paying union jobs across the country.
I hear you saying that, but as you're aware, Texas has not been a union state traditionally. And notwithstanding the creation of new jobs, there are going to be severe dislocations to workers in the oil industry and all the associated industries up and down, no?
Well, let me say this. Part of our climate plan involves holding workers in industries that could decline or will decline harmless so that we will guarantee their wages, their health care, and their retirement. The last thing we want to do is solve the climate problem on the backs of American working people. And we've put the money aside in our plan, $50 billion. That's not to say that the dislocation for specific workers isn't real. We will make sure that they're at the front of the line to get the new jobs that definitely will be there, including specifically in Texas.
We've been talking to some of the other challengers in the race, among them Joe Biden, and I asked him about mandatory gun buybacks, because it's obviously an issue on the minds of a lot of folks here in Texas. You're aware of the shootings in El Paso and in Midland, Odessa. What would a Tom Steyer administration do when it comes to the question of mandatory gun buybacks?
I'm not in favor of mandatory gun buybacks. I am in favor of reducing gun violence across our country. The Second Amendment is a right of Americans, but it is not the only right of Americans. So, in fact, when I talk about gun violence, I'm talking about background checks for people buying guns that I think everybody in America, including members of the NRA, agree with. I'm talking about licensing gun owners just the way we license car owners and registering ARs. And, in fact, people should know I raise cattle, chicken, and pigs about an hour and 15 minutes south of San Francisco in California. And our ranch provides free gun safety courses for anybody in the neighborhood who wants to be a safe gun owner and get a hunting license. Like all rights of Americans, it comes into conflict sometimes with other rights. So, for instance, you have a right to free speech, but not the right to yell fire in a crowded theater.
We have such a short amount of time and so much ground to cover, but I want to touch on some of the things that you've been making news for. And I have to mention, there was a gotcha question that someone in Nevada threw you the other day. You probably know the one. Had to do with, do you know the Mexican president's name? And you said it, you had forgotten it. And you know, I think a lot of people feel like something you can Google is not really fair. But I think it is fair to ask, how would your approach to the Mexican administration change? I mean, by Mr. Trump's own measure, his pressure on the Mexican president has resulted in the military closing its southern border to parades of migrants from Central America. Would you want to alter your position with respect to AMLO, Andrés Manuel López Obrador?
Well, let me say this, David. I did forget his name. I also described exactly his background and his party.
Right.
So I knew exactly who I was talking about. I came out of that and I thought, oh my gosh, I forget so many names all the time. If it's a question about remembering names, then I really am in trouble.
No, I totally hear you. So, I totally understand. But the substantive question.
That was funny. But the substantive question is this. Mr. Trump has a foreign policy that involves confrontation and escalation. That's what he's done across the board everywhere. And that's what he's done with Mexico. That is not the policy that I believe is best for the United States of America. I think that for us to succeed, to make our country more prosperous and safer across the board, what we should be doing is working with other countries and negotiating really hard for Americans, but understanding that long term, it's better for us if Mexico and America succeed together. So if you look at what President Obama did in working with our allies to pressure Iran to give up its nuclear ambitions, that was us taking a value-driven lead, putting together a coalition and working to get a regime that is antithetical to us in so many ways to do something that made us safer and made the world safer.
You know what? I thought you were going to refer to President Obama's approach when it came to the deportations of people who were here undocumented, because there was, I believe, something like 3 million people deported over that period while he was in office.
Look, I have a different attitude about immigration. I believe Mr. Trump is dealing with immigration on a racist basis. And I believe that he has been breaking international law and breaking the laws of humanity in the way that he's treated people coming here seeking asylum. And so I would end that on day one. I believe that we should be a value-driven country, which is what we've always been. That's what the United States is supposed to be. Lead the world in freedom, justice, and equality.
You said undocumented workers are an open secret. What would you do about them as president?
Well, let me put it to you this way, David. There are 12 million people here who've been here an average of 15 years. Everybody in the United States knows it. They pay taxes. Their kids go to school. I would give them the legal status. And I would do what Ronald Reagan did, which is do comprehensive immigration reform and give them a path to citizenship as soon as possible.
Texas has the largest number of uninsured people in the nation. What would President Steyer do about that? And would you have the support of Congress?
First of all, I believe that affordable health care is a right for every American, literally. And I believe that we pay way too much for it. I believe the government has dramatically fallen down on the job in terms of fighting back against these corporations who are basically ripping us off. About a quarter of the uninsured in Texas are kids. So given what I think, I am someone who believes that we should have a public option as part of the Affordable Care Act, that anybody can join Medicare, and that we should use the government's negotiating power across all its areas of buying to take on these corporations and drive down those costs, because it's eating people alive. The reason that I'm not for Medicare for all is this. 160 million Americans get their health care through their employment. My goal is to make the public option as part of the Affordable Care Act so cheap and so good that everybody who's got their health care through their employer goes to their employer and says, give me the money. I'll buy the public option and I'll get a raise. But my belief is, hey, it's their choice. And honestly, I think that there's a huge question about how much Medicare for All is going to cost.
You know a lot about the bottom line, clearly. I mean, as a former hedge fund manager and that sort of thing, I mention that because you've said that you're on a mission to reduce the influence of the powerful and well-connected. Are you yourself what regular folks would consider part of the powerful and well-connected? And if not, how do you convince them that you're on their side?
You know, David, I did start a business on my own. I never inherited a penny from my parents. I started a business. I built it up over 27 years into a multi-billion dollar international business. And I walked away from it and took a pledge to give most of my money to charities while I'm alive. But let me say this. For the last 10 years, I have been organizing coalitions of ordinary American citizens to take on unchecked corporate power, to take on the corporations who bought our government. And I've never lost. So, you know, if you really think that the government in Washington, D.C. has been bought by corporations, which I really think, and you really think that we're not going to get any of the things that Americans want, like affordable health care and quality public education and a living wage, clean air and clean water, if you don't think we're getting any of that stuff until we break the corporate stranglehold on our government, then you got to ask, who actually will get that done? My argument is the energy always comes from the grassroots. The energy always comes from the outside. You know, that's why I'm someone who's for term limits. Congress is not a lifetime appointment, 12 years for congresspeople and senators. Let's get a wiggle on. Let's put new and different people in charge and make some changes.
Tom Steyer wants to make some changes. He is one of the Democrats who's running for president of the United States, and his name is going to be on the ballot here in Texas on Super Tuesday come March 3rd. If you registered to vote, of course, early voting gets underway today. Tom Steyer, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
David Brown, it's a treat to be with you.
All right, let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, find out what Texans are talking about on this Tuesday. What you see out there?
Hi, David. Well, sticking with politics, albeit at the state level, some big news in the Texas Senate. Austin State Senator Kirk Watson, one of the chamber's most prominent Democrats, is leaving for academia. The senator made it official this morning, notifying the governor that his last day in office would be April 30th. Watson is leaving to become the inaugural dean at the University of Houston's Hobby School of Public Affairs. Yeah. On our Facebook page, Jonathan Lal says the legislature pays so little, he's probably getting a huge raise going over there. And Diane Trader says, this makes me sad. Kirk has been a force for good in the Texas legislature. His leadership will be missed, but the chance to mold young minds may very well be a much longer lasting legacy. Interesting news no one really saw coming this Tuesday morning, and it's just one of the stories we're watching so far.
You know, Boy Scouts based in Texas declaring bankruptcy. Yeah. I know that they're going to be talking about that a little bit later on in the Texas Roundup. Stick around. We're going to have Wells Dunbar back with more of your comments in about 35 here on The Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose research has helped bring more than 90 cancer-fighting drugs to the marketplace. Patients can access national clinical trials phases 1-4 in their communities. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where horned frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We've talked about the start of early voting, a theme in our broadcast today. One group virtually all campaigns trying to target leading up to Super Tuesday is Latinos. Over this past weekend, dozens of young Latinos from around Texas gathered to hear from presidential, congressional, and state office candidates, disappointing some attendees with their absence. Estella Chavez of KERA North Texas reports.
The event kicked off with mariachis playing outside Slocum Auditorium at San Jacinto College in Pasadena. The campus is located southeast of Houston, but students came from around the state. Organizers registered new voters, and attendees held signs that read, No Manches, or No Way, and Órale, or Right On. None of the Democratic presidential candidates attended. Instead, the Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden campaigns sent surrogates, and Tom Steyer and Bernie Sanders spoke via video calls. The event was sponsored by Jolt, which describes itself as the largest progressive Latino organization in Texas. Antonio Arellano, Jolt's interim executive director, says Texas is a battleground state. and that politicians should pay attention to young voters of color.
Texas has 38 electoral votes, 36 congressional seats. We're a powerhouse. And come Super Tuesday, we're one of the biggest prizes. So we want to make sure that young Latinos recognize that they have in their hands the power and the potential to transform this state.
Among the topics raised during the event, climate change, funding for mental health services, and paying for college. I'm Stella Chavez in Pasadena.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Texas cities are often thought of as rather modern and growing fast, but there are a lot of places with ties to the old days which have certainly seen better days. Perhaps you live in such a place. Those who happen to call an older apartment building home are used to complaining about faulty air conditioners, appliances that don't do what they're supposed to, sometimes even mold. Landlords may or may not be sufficiently intimidated by an official citation, but in the Texas capital city, Audrey McGlinchey of KUT reports the code department has been sitting on an enforcement tool for years, one that could be very persuasive to reluctant landlords.
The hot water.
All right, so let me feel
and
it.
I've got a, somewhere I've got a thermometer.
So it's still cold. Stephen Frischmuth's been without hot water for a week.
Oh, here it is.
Still cold. This is some real investigative work, people. Okay, we're sticking a thermometer in the water. Frischmuth lives in an apartment complex in North Austin. There, he says, he's often fighting for basic amenities. It says about 70, but this does not feel like 70 to me. As you might imagine, living without hot water makes everyday tasks hard.
Kitchen full of filthy dishes. I can't take a proper shower.
When a tenant has a problem, they can call 311 and it'll go to the city's code department. An inspector will come out and may issue a violation. If the landlord doesn't make the fixes, it could escalate to a fine. Currently, Frischmuth's landlord owes a little over $6,000 to the city. But even with these fines, there's still no hot water. So tenants like Frischmuth and housing advocates say the city should take bolder action. But before we get to that, let's back up a bit.
Four people were forced to pack up and move out after their South Austin apartments are deemed just too dangerous. Good afternoon. I'm Leslie Rohde.
I'm Robert Hadlock.
In 2012, at least two dozen families were evacuated from their apartment building on East Riverside after a balcony collapsed. When city inspectors showed up, they found lots of other code violations.
It's a mass exodus at the Woodridge apartment complex after dozens more residents were kicked out on Monday.
As KXAN reported at the time, some kids even had to miss school.
They had 20 minutes to move out.
After code compliance officers inspected the apartments, even more buildings were deemed unsafe to live in.
That really was a wake-up call to the community that we needed to put a better focus on our rental properties.
Daniel Word is with the city's code department. Even with something as dramatic as a balcony collapse, it took council members a year to pass something. In 2013, they voted to create a program that would keep an eye on problem properties, called the Repeat Offender Program. Basically, if a landlord's been cited for health and safety issues several times in a two-year period,
broken windows, to something as, you know, a loose handrail or a loose step on a set of stairs,
they have to pay a fee, and the property goes on a public list. The property's then subject to periodic inspections. When the city created the program, they gave themselves this power. If a landlord isn't making repairs, they can no longer rent to new tenants. It's a muscle the city's waited more than 6 years to flex. Why did it take the city so long to give itself the ability to do that?
Correct. So, again, the ordinance was implemented in 2013, but it was a brand new ordinance and it was a brand new program. So it took some time to get the ordinance up and running, get the staffing in place to handle the ordinance.
But Frischmuth, who, by the way, got his hot water back, and his neighbors say the 6 years that passed was time they sometimes spent without basic amenities. Take Jose Perez, his wife Mariana, and their two kids. They were afraid of their stove. Yep, you heard that right.
Pues le tenemos miedo a la estufa.
Perez said as much to a city commission this past August. He described, through a translator, how he thought the appliance in his apartment's kitchen had faulty wiring. How, when he tried to use it, sometimes it would catch fire. One time, his family even used soda to put out the flames.
Ya una vez, La tuvimos que apagar con Coca-Cola.
One of the managers of the building was sitting at this city commission. The next day, Perez says he got a new stove. But this was after 3 years, Perez told me, and having asked nearly 20 times for the stove to be fixed. So when he hears that the code department says it takes time to start enforcing something, something he and others say they think will force landlords to make repairs faster, Perez extends an invitation.
Yo los invitaría a ellos personalmente.
He's saying he personally invites code employees.
Que si ellos pudieran pasar una noche o un fin de semana en un apartamento sin servicios.
To stay a night or a weekend in an apartment without services like his family has.
Como nosotros lo pasamos, entenderían y tomarían acciones.
Then they would understand and take action, he says. Perez and Frischmuth hope their landlord will be the first sanctioned by the city. The company that owns the property did not respond to a request for comment. As for the code department, it says this month it'll begin considering which properties they may start penalizing. For the Texas Standard, I'm Audrey McGlinchey.
Once upon a time, a Texas-based store made a national name for itself by bringing in goods from all around the world. You could accessorize your home as if you'd done all the traveling and paid customs to boot. It was 1966, and the Fort Worth-based company took on the name Pier 1. Hippie beads and incense used to be what brought a lot of people through the door back in those early days. Problem is, not so many people coming through the door these days, what with Amazon and Wayfair. The Associated Press reports the company submitted a bankruptcy filing this week after years of declining sales. They plan to borrow $256 million from lenders and pursue a sale of the company. We are coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Tarrazas. The Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy overnight. Texas Standard's Alexandra Hart explains why the Irving-based group is taking this step.
The 110-year-old organization is seeking financial relief as it faces roughly 300 lawsuits from men who say they were sexually abused while they were scouts. The group hired a law firm for possible Chapter 11 filing in December of 2018. The BSA said in a statement it's filing for bankruptcy to, quote, compensate victims harmed during their time in scouting and continue carrying on its mission for years to come, end quote.
The Boy Scouts of America says it plans to use the Chapter 11 process to create a victims' compensation trust. Early voting is now underway for the 2020 Texas primaries. KUT's Matt Largy has more.
Primary elections are where parties choose their nominees to compete in the general election in November. Most polling places are open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. If you're voting in person, remember to bring a photo ID, though you can still cast a ballot if you sign a form declaring that you had a reasonable impediment to getting an acceptable form of ID. If you plan to vote by mail, make sure you sent an application to vote by mail by the February 21st deadline. Texas doesn't have party registration, so you can vote in either the Republican or Democratic primary, but not in both. Texas voters will play a big part in the yet unsettled race for the Democratic nomination for president, but there are also races for Congress, the state legislature, and county offices on the primary ballot. Early voting runs through Friday, February 28th. Election day is March 3rd. I'm Matt Largy in Austin.
Nearly all of the Democrats seeking the nomination to challenge Republican U.S. Senator John Cornyn will participate in a debate tonight. Yesterday, just three of the candidates participated in the first and only debate focused exclusively on climate change. It was hosted by several environmental groups.
I'm the only candidate in this race that has dealt with the issues from a policy standpoint with results.
I think infrastructure investment is critically important.
When we talk about making sure that we become the largest solar producing state, the reason other countries are already doing that is because they have federal investment to make that happen.
That was State Senator Royce West of Dallas, former Houston City Council member Amanda Edwards, and labor organizer Cristina Tsinsun Ramirez. A dozen candidates are running in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. State Senator Kirk Watson is retiring from the Texas Senate. The Austin Democrat says his resignation will be effective at midnight on April 30th. Watson is leaving his post to become the founding dean of the University of Houston's Hobby School of Public Affairs. Watson was first elected to the Texas Senate in 2006. I'm Lauren Tarrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University, focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. An expression, a reminder, a piece of art. What does a tattoo mean to you? Well, these days, more than one of every four adults has at least one tattoo, and where previous generations of polite Western society would stigmatize the wearing of ink, those born since the 1970s have more willingly embraced tattoos as a perfectly acceptable way of communicating identity and belonging. But how much have social norms really changed? Researchers at Baylor and Texas Tech have just concluded a study of one particular type of body art which may offer some hints. Theirs is a study of religious tattoos. Kevin Doherty is an associate professor of sociology at Baylor University, and he co-authored this study. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Pleasure to be with you.
Why would a religious tattoo be conceptually different or distinct from any other tattoo?
Well, for a long time in the United States, religion acted as a deterrent to tattoos. Tattoos were often on men not in mainstream society, associated with sailors, biker gangs, people that had spent time incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And for generations of Americans, the idea of a tattoo as an acceptable means of communication and self-expression was really foreign. So the proliferation of religious tattoos that people like me see on a college campus like Baylor University is really quite surprising historically.
I want to get to the methodology here. I gather that your study looked at something like more than 700 photos of tattoos taken at a Christian university. 20% of these tattoos had a religious content. And what else did you find about these tattoos?
Well, all tattoos are a proclamation of identity and affiliation, particularly those that are visible. But the orientation of a tattoo can be either primarily for others, and that would be a tattoo on someone's outer shoulder,
mm-hmm.
that if you saw that, you'd immediately recognize the symbol, or it would be visible to you, as opposed to inward-facing or self-facing tattoos, such as on the wrist or the forearm, that might look upside down to someone else, but when held up to the owner, is perfectly legible and easy to read. And religious tattoos, we found in our research at Baylor, were more likely than non-religious tattoos to face the owner.
So serving the function of a kind of a reminder of
sorts? Absolutely, right. Yeah. In addition to being a proclamation of identity, the religious tattoo seems to be a reminder of identity, a way for an individual to encourage themselves to think about identity, maybe to think about acting in accordance with their own religious convictions and beliefs. And this does seem to make religious tattoos different than putting a tattoo of your favorite sports team or your university or the city that you grew up in, which are more likely to face outward.
Well, did you find any other distinctions when it comes to sort of, demographic breakdowns, race, gender, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we sure did. We looked at gender in particular, and we found that religious tattoos are in different places of the body for men and for women. For men, like tattoos in general, they tend to be larger than 3 inches, mm-hmm. and in more prominent places, the upper arm, the forearm, places that are more easily visible to others. For women, their religious tattoos were in places that could be more easily hidden, the wrist, the foot, the back, places that can be covered with clothing or a watch band or socks, and they tended to be smaller in size. So although men and women both had religious tattoos, and society in the United States today, men and women are equally likely to have a tattoo, the placement of these religious tattoos and the size of them did differ for men and women in the photos that we had.
What constitutes, for the purposes of your study, a religious tattoo?
We had two different people go through all of the 752 photos and classify them as either obviously religious or not obviously religious. So things like the cross, the Star of David, the Virgin Mary. So these types of things were classified as obviously or overtly religious. And the two independent reviewers that went through that, they agreed 97% of the time. So we have pretty good confidence that the tattoos that we've classified, most people would recognize as religious.
I have to ask, Professor, do you have any ink?
I have a tattoo, one tattoo acquired in college, and it does have religious significance.
How interesting. This is a fascinating study. We're going to link to the top line findings over at texasstandard.org. We've been speaking with Kevin Doherty. He's an associate professor of sociology at Baylor, and he co-authored this study with a colleague at Texas Tech. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes to speak with us on The Standard, Professor.
Happy to be with you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
Hello, my name is Michaela Ulmer, and I am a student, a bee ambassador, and the founder and CEO of Me and the Bees Lemonade. So I'm currently 15. I started my company when I was 4.5 years old here in Austin, Texas, and it started as a simple lemonade stand. I kept on doing it, and as I grew, I learned that the CEO is like the queen bee. Like, they are in charge of kind of running the hive. So I kind of wanted to name myself the CEO because it was my company, and I came up with the idea, and I started it, and I'm the person who helps it grow. We just reformulated. We just reduced about 25% of the sugars in our lemonade. So it has honey, it has monk fruit, which is like, I think it's like stevia without the aftertaste, but it's a natural sweetener. And then we also have sugar. So the reason why is because we use honey, which is a pretty expensive sweetener. If we did 100% honey, it would be pretty expensive. And I want my lemonade to be accessible to multiple people, like to everybody. So that's why we have it partially sweetened with honey, and then we also have sugar in it as well. But yes, that's why the Me and the Bees comes in, is because we donate about 10% of the proceeds that we make to organizations that are helping save the bees, like the Healthy Hive, and then it's also sweetened with honey. So my parents, when I came up to them and told them I want to take my product and maybe sell it all year round to figure out how I can save the bees all year round, instead of saying, okay, why don't you wait till you're like 18 or until you've done the lemonade stand for a couple of years, they said, okay, let's figure out how to do it. Let's go to the library and check out some books so you can learn. By reading empowering books about little kids who wanted to be scientists or African Americans who like wanted to be astronauts, it kind of, I think, set the mentality of like, I can do anything. And especially having the not when I grow up I want to be, but whenever I want to be it, I can be this mentality is also, I think, very important. This is Michaela Ulmer, the founder and CEO of Me and the Bees Lemonade, and you're listening to Texas Standard.
Coming up on 43 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time, I'm David Brown. When it comes to making good barbecue, what are the important elements? The wood you choose, the smoker you're using, what about the grade of the meat? Well, of course, all of those are important, but some might say that the most important is the actual smoke. Well, you know what they say, where there's smoke, there's Daniel Vaughn, barbecue editor for Texas Monthly Magazine, and Daniel, I understand you met a man who set out on a quest to find the perfect barbecue smoke. Who is Bill Carew?
Yeah, Bill Carew, he's a barbecue pit builder. He not only went out to find the perfect barbecue smoke, but to really design a smoker that would create that perfect barbecue smoke over and over.
What is the perfect barbecue smoke?
Well, for him, it's smoke that's not dirty. And by dirty meaning, it's not smoke that is comes from wood that hasn't been fully combusted. For him, clean smoke is from wood that's been fully combusted.
When I think combusted, I think burned.
That's right. Yeah, wood that's on fire and smoke that's on fire. It really wasn't until I talked to Bill that I realized that wood itself is only a fuel source. It's not really the fuel. The fuel is the coals that's created from the burning wood, and also the flame that comes from burning smoke. And if you choke off that flame, if you choke off oxygen to the fire, mm-hmm. and that smoke can't ignite, then that smoke can't go through its sort of normal filtering process, burn the dirt off of it, burn those dirty ashtray flavors off of it, and those flavors all then land on your meat or on the inside
of your smoker. This is fascinating because you're right. I have always presumed that it was the wood that was burning and that would produce smoke, and the smoke would get on your meat, and that would be what would give the barbecue the flavor. But what I hear you saying is that the smoke itself is burning.
That's right. And he really separates the idea of power and flavor coming from the wood. So power being the actual heat that's coming from the wood that really comes from the wood coals, and then flavor coming from that burning smoke.
Wow.
And that if you rely too much on the burning smoke for your power, then you really have this really big up and down swing in the temperature of your pit, because you have wood that's burning and going out. You have to add new wood, get it started again. Whereas if you have a nice coal bed to work with, then you have all that power coming from the coals.
Interesting.
And you can add then smaller pieces of wood to get that flavor.
This is absolutely fascinating. So you could, in theory, have a certain kind of patina of flavor on, say, the top of your meat, but not really have it as fully cooked as it needed to be to make it a quality piece of barbecue.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a lot of people would say once it gets the right color in your smoker, mm-hmm. then maybe it's time to wrap it up in butcher paper or foil so it doesn't get any more smoke on it. The way that Bill cooks, it's really just made for cooking without wrapping, or what some people call bareback cooking.
So he went through several iterations trying to put together the perfect smoker, right?
Yeah, more than a dozen. Right now he's got the KBQ-18, which is like an 18th version of the smoker that he's designed. And basically he started off because all these barbecue road trips he went on, he would see these sort of smoke stalactites hanging from the ceiling, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. dripping off of the smoker lids and
I've seen
and
that
exhausts.
At Smitty's. It's got this epic sort of swirl of black grossness that's hanging from the brickwork there.
Yes, that's certainly what Bill Carew thought was kind of grossness as well. And he really didn't like that creosote flavor that developed on the meat, mm-hmm. through cooking with that dirty smoke. And so he was trying to create a smoker that would produce good, clean smoke 100% of the time. You know, he understands that, when I'm talking about a coal bed and putting small pieces of wood on it, that requires a lot of attention and also requires a lot of skill. That's normally the way that you would cook in a big, 1,000-gallon offset smoker at a barbecue joint. But not everybody has that sort of skill or understanding of fire. So he wanted to create a smoker that didn't require that knowledge. And he came up with what's called the inverted firebox.
Mm-hmm.
And the inverted firebox is ingenious because the firebox, the wood that's burning, is actually above the box where the meat is, the smoking chamber. And the smoke is drawn down through the fire, through the coal bed,
gosh.
Down into the smoker, therefore sort of purifying or filtering out that smoke because it goes through that superheated coal bed before it enters into the smoker box.
Daniel, final question. Can you taste a difference in the way that this barbecue prepared by this method, that it tastes?
Well, the stuff that comes out of the KBQ can't really taste a difference, but you can certainly taste that it's been smoked properly. Like, it doesn't taste any better than what comes out of a great offset smoker at a good barbecue joint. but it certainly doesn't taste anything like the dirty smoke, the sort of black soot that you would get on it from a place that doesn't know how to build a proper fire.
Well, you know, where there's smoke, clean smoke, there's fire, and that's where you'll find Daniel Vaughn. He follows the clean smoke as barbecue editor for Texas Monthly. Read all about it over at texasmonthly.com. We'll have a link to his article at our own website. Daniel, good to talk with you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Look at that. We're coming up on 49 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. You know what that means, right? Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, is going to be joining us here in the studio in just a couple of minutes. Have you let us know what's making news in your part of Texas? Well, tweet us at Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In 2018, a newcomer pulled off one of the biggest upsets in election history. Progressive firebrand Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from the Bronx defeated 10-term incumbent Joe Crowley in the Democratic primary for New York's 14th Congressional District, going on to become U.S. Representative. It was a victory that shook the world. Well, now a handful of progressive candidates are hoping to pull off a similar feat here in the Lone Star State, taking on two long-tenured U.S. representatives from the Houston area. Here to tell us more, Jeremy Wallace. He's political reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jeremy, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Well, always great to be with you.
Let's talk about these two races in particular. Both of these Democrats have been in office for quite a while. Sheila Jackson Lee is one of them, right?
Yeah, you're talking about a quarter century that she's been essentially in office, and she has rarely drawn any opposition. Just three times in her career has she faced any primary opposition from other Democrats. In each one of those cases, it was really mostly token opposition, and she easily defeated those candidates.
So
what about her?
You're saying this year is different. Who's the challenger in particular that she has to worry about?
Well, this year she has six candidates who have jumped in against her. And when I first started reaching out to these folks, I wondered what kind of candidates they were. They're all relatively professional people. They're Mark Flores has been in the real estate business for a long time, a young man who's been able to raise a decent amount of money, not anything close to what Sheila Jackson Lee has, but you know he's doing quite well. Steven Zarosco is a young firebrand that, you know, boy, when I went door to door with him as he was going through the neighborhoods, and he sounded like AOC. You know, it's like he has a lot of the progressive energy that you expect to hear from them. So I think those two candidates are particularly strong. And there's an older fella named Jerry Ford who's running in that race, a former firefighter who is a blunt, you know, takes it straight to you and tells you that he's walked through fire before. And so he's not intimidated to take on any of these incumbents.
So it's not strictly a generational thing. But I want to turn to one of the other candidates who faces a challenge. This is a long-term U.S. Representative Al Green, right?
Well, in his case, he's never had a primary opponent. You know, people just haven't run against him since he got elected until this year. Melissa Wilson is a single mom and a broker, a real estate broker, that is. And you know, she said she just felt like she had to step up and do something. So she's trying to juggle being a mom and a businesswoman and take him on. And when you speak to her, she clearly knows the issues. Whether or not she can get the funding, to be able to give him the same kind of spirited challenge we're kind of seeing a little bit more of in the Sheila Jackson Lee race, that remains to be seen. But it's still nonetheless making, Al Green have to do something he hasn't done since 2004.
You know, the thing that strikes me as different about these two races when you compare it to, say, what's happening down in South Texas, where you have Congressman Henry Cuellar with a challenge from a 26-year-old immigration attorney who used to be his intern, Jessica Cisneros. There you have a situation where you have a conservative Democrat. In fact, Henry Cuellar is largely considered to be one of the most conservative Democrats in Congress. But on But here, you're talking about Sheila Jackson Lee and Al Green, both of whom are not considered conservative at all. So what I wonder is what these challenges in the Houston area say about the soul of the Democratic Party in Texas.
Well, and that's a really good point because, like you said, they're not considered conservative Democrats, yet for these, particularly for the younger challengers, they are not liberal enough on a lot of these issues. They, you know, even being from Houston, they want to see these candidates take a more aggressive stance in support of things like the Green New Deal. And they're trying to apply pressure, not just to, you know, challenge them in this election. As some of them have been telling me, they want to move the politics of these, you know, older generational primary opponents and steer them more towards the direction of AOCs of the world and less from the Nancy Pelosi wing of the party. And so, yes, you know, I think even, you know, with candidates who already are considered to be, you know, certainly not conservative Democrats, they want to push these people further to the left. And I think that's what, you know, trying to wrap my head around is how much more space there is on the left. Hmm. Well, when you listen to these folks go door to door, they see a lot more space to go.
Jeremy Wallace covers politics for the Houston Chronicle. We'll have a link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Jeremy, thanks again.
No, appreciate it. Thank you.
And you were listening to the Texas Standard. Well, I told you he'd be back. It's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Wells, what are folks talking about on this Tuesday?
Hey, David. Here's an interesting one. A controlled implosion in North Texas over the weekend didn't go quite according to plan. I think you might know what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about the latest landmark in the Metroplex, the Leaning Tower of Dallas. Here's the backstory. On Sunday, an 11-story building near downtown Dallas was imploded to make way for new construction. But as the Dallas Morning News reports, a large interior concrete column, including the building's elevator shaft, refused to topple over, and it does markedly lean to one side.
They don't build them like they used to.
They sure don't. I tell you what, the wrecking crew is expected to knock it down shortly should gravity not work. But for now, Dallas does have a lovely new landmark. Videos of the implosion and that remaining tower plastered all over Twitter, including our account. And our pal Jimmy O, he got out there to the site and tweeted us a couple pictures of this new addition to the Dallas skyline. So quite a sight there. The sort of thing you see every day.
Nice photography there, Jimmy.
Yeah. hearing from folks about other topics on the show. As you noted, today marks the start of early voting in Texas. Primary election goes for 10 days and it's February 28th, election day, falling on March 3rd. Hearing from folks about what their plans are for turning out to the polls, whether or not they're going to hit early voting. Lynn Watson Guy says yes, going early voting tomorrow. And Susan Rayburn says she's researched the candidates and made up her mind already.
Wow.
Saw an interesting, definitely. Saw an interesting tweet earlier from someone.
It was that works.
Blanket on a name there. Christopher Hooks.
Political
writer here. Appeared on the show. He made a very interesting point. It's like, can you imagine now what's going to happen between now and Election Day, the Democratic primary, presidential primary, so fast moving. It really would be fascinating to see if you were to vote today versus what it's going to, how the lay of the land is going to be.
I mean, you know, we've been talking about how Bloomberg has spent so much money. He's got a major investment here in the Lone Star State, 19 field offices.
Yeah,
I think
wild
he's got
stuff.
150 staffers. Well, New York Times is now reporting his support is at 19% in the polls, which puts him just behind Bernie Sanders in the national level. What's pretty amazing, he's going to be on the stage on Wednesday in the next Democratic debate. So it'll be the first time he's sort of part of that big field that's been
hasn't been a part of any debate so far. So we're really going to see. I think many people watching to see if this sort of tension ratchets up between Bloomberg and Sanders, and because we've already seen signs of it flaring up, whether or not that's really going to take off full bore, we'll find out.
I wonder how many people have started receiving text messages from the candidates here in Texas. Anyone? Hello, I see some hands up. Here in the studio, let us hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Digging this groovy music. How about you? All right, we're out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.